Howard, author and co-creator of HBO's Vinyl, Rich Cohen, DuPage County Board Chairman Dan Cronin, and from the band Iron and Wine, Joe Adamnick. And now here's your host, a man who thinks the Lucas Museum should go where the Sears is at on Lawrence, Justin Kaufman.
Topical. All right, welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. We have an amazing show lined up for you tonight. Nice mix of politics, music, philosophy, and fantasy baseball. So there you go. We got it all. Later this hour, we'll catch up with DuPage County Board Chairman Dan Cronin. Cronin just gave his annual speech to the City Club about issues in DuPage County. One of the big issues, of course, is the state budget. But Cronin has been busy balancing his. We'll talk about the issues and his big push to consolidate and shrink government in the county that is called DuPage. My guest tonight at the big table is author Rich Cohen. Cohen is the co-creator of the HBO show Vinyl. He created the show with some no-names named Mick Jagger and Martin Scorsese. Whatever, name drop. He met Jagger as a 20-something writer following the Rolling Stones for Rolling Stone magazine. His new book is called The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Can't wait to talk to him about his experiences and what he learned about the biggest rock band in the world. The takeaway, they didn't really like each other. Speaking of music, we're going to have some live music tonight from one of Chicago's greats. Drummer Joe Adamnick has a new solo record. Joe was the drummer for the Chicago indie outfit Caliphone, and he's currently with Iron and Wine. We'll talk to him about his new music, his solo project, his album Super Low. Hear some of it and get a better insight to making music and a living here in Chicago. And now that Trump is the presumptive nominee and Clinton has pretty much wrapped up her bid, I've heard more and more people say that, you know what, they're probably going to sit this election out. Not so fast, says our resident philosopher Al Genie. We'll talk about what it truly means to vote in our society, regardless of who's running. And fantasy sports is about to be seriously regulated. States are lining up to tax and license companies like FanDuel and DraftKings. But what about smaller companies and people that play the games? Are we just going to get lost in the wash? We'll find out. Talk about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Huge show tonight. Very excited. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Pete Zimmerman is on the board. He's the production wizard, as I call him, Zim, DJ Zim. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right. Why don't we get to it, right? Let's do the carry out. Of course, this is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Governor Rauner got into the Lucas Museum fray. Of course he did. That's where all the lights are. Rauner bristled at the idea of the raising of the old McCormick Place to make way for the museum because of the money it would take. Rauner was like, $500 million of state money? Hey, that's like a Friday night for me, and I love my Friday nights. That was my Rauner impression. I will say that I still like the idea of putting the museum on the party barge. Art and real estate agents in bikinis doing jello shots? That's gold. FBI sources told the Washington Post that there is scant evidence that Hillary Clinton violated classified document rules with her emails. Scant evidence. Upon hearing this, Republicans were like, yes! So you're telling me there's still a chance? Cook County Circuit Court Clerk Dorothy Brown, wow, say that five times fast, isn't letting a federal probe into her office stop her from asking for a raise. You know we've got the secret tapes of that meeting where Brown met with her boss, Tony Preckwinkle. Why don't we listen in?
President, you know, I would like a...
No.
There you have it. The Chicago Teachers Union voted against a strike this school year, so CPS rejoice. You got 3 months. A Goonies-like police chase took the Chicago area by storm last night. It started in Lombard, crisscrossed around the Chicagoland area, including high speeds on Sheridan Road and on the north side. And the perps got away! This would have never happened in L.A. If it were in L.A., the news would have cut in while you were watching Empire and followed those cars via helicopter till the morning news came on. And then when it ended, we'd sell that chase to best maximum car chases ever on UPN. That's what you do with a police chase! What's wrong with you, Chicago? Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez may have lost her re-election bid, but not her mind. She has recused herself and asked for a special prosecutor in the case against police officer Jason Van Dyke. Van Dyke is awaiting trial on murder charges in the Laquan McDonald case. When asked why, Alvarez said, not it. I agree with her. I mean, she's really just keeping the seat warm. If it were me, I'd be using every sick day and attending every Arizona conference I could in the last few months. Trying a case against a police officer that will end with somebody being angry? Kim Fox, welcome to your new job. Tomorrow, Wicker Park will be the site of a Prince tribute parade. Wait, is it a Prince tribute parade or just a regular Friday afternoon in Wicker Park? Always hard to tell. Ah, hey, you love Prince? No, man, I just love purple. Hey, watch me play my djembe. The Sears in Ravenswood is going to close after 90 years in business, prompting locals to say, now where am I going to get my nothing? In weather, it's so nice out today. It's so nice, it's like spring training for the Michigan Avenue Panhandlers. They stayed out a couple extra hours today, stretching out for opening day, so they can get their stamina up to a full 8 hours for singing Under the Boardwalk. In sports, the Cubs take on the NL East leading Nationals tonight at Wrigley. The Cubs are the first team to 20 wins, and if that's not impressive enough, Nate Silver breaks down all the numbers and concludes that the Cubs have the hottest start in the history of baseball. Are you kidding me? Hayward's still out, which is fine when you got a guy named Tommy La Stella. Great baseball name. The Cubs are back at Wrigley, and to celebrate their return and Cinco de Mayo, a mariachi band played in the clubhouse, which was probably really awkward when the players changed clothes. The White Sox, come on, 19 wins, losers. No, the White Sox look to win the series tonight at the Cell against the Red Sox. The White Sox are throwing Eric Johnson tonight. What, is he the replacement for John Danks? Hope you got that one figured out, Southsiders. I say you got to bring up the kid from Vandy now. In the NBA playoffs, who cares? Still too soon, Bulls. And finally, today is Cinco de Mayo. It's a day to eat taco salads and hit up your favorite Chipotle because Hispanics have a great tradition of people stealing their traditions. But come on, everybody loves kale guacamole, right? Anyway, happy birthday, Mexico! That's the carryout for May 5th, 2016. Hey, we've got a nacho special tonight. Well, it's just melted cheese. Skip the chips. It's healthier for you. I'm such a jag. More to come tonight on the download. Dan Cronin, the DuPage County Board Chair, is going to join us to talk about DuPage County and consolidating government at 8 o'clock at the big table. Author Rich Cohen. It's a download here on WGN Radio. Stay with us. All right. More to come on the show. Dan Cronin's going to be here, the DuPage County Board Chair. Also, Rich Cohen coming up at 8 o'clock. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Yeah, not a lot of things going on in DuPage County these days, huh?
No, nothing.
I mean, the College of DuPage alone is enough to keep everybody
right,
busy.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because Cronin just did the State of DuPage County, essentially. He does it every year at the City Club here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent most of his time talking about the state budget. I just listened to it. And also about reducing government. Like, he's on this big kick to consolidate and reduce the size of government. And I don't know how you even do that. I mean, that's a noble thing, and you hear a lot of politicians talking about that. But, geez, try to get your driver's license to see.
Well, it's an amazing balancing act because you look at that idea of let's try to streamline things, and it sounds good when you talk about
right.
it. But then when you look at all the services that various parts of government provide, you know, then you start going, okay, well, where are the redundancies? And then you try to look for those, and I mean, it's a mess.
You know what? It's funny because it's sort of like I'm glad that he's doing it.
Yeah, we just get to talk about it, criticize it, and report on
it.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah, we've got the easy job.
So easy. Welcome back to the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, earlier this month, DuPage County Board Chairman Dan Cronin delivered a speech at the City Club of Chicago. It kind of almost serves as the state of DuPage County. Cronin's been the chairman of the DuPage County Board since 2010. One of the biggest moves has been reducing the size of DuPage County government. He's decreased the budget by $30 million, and he continues to advocate for consolidating local government. In the speech, Cronin talks about GOP politics, the state budget standstill, and the needs facing DuPage County, including what could be his motto, do more with less. Before this job, Cronin was in Springfield for 20 years as both a representative and a senator. Dan Cronin joins me now on the line. Chairman Cronin, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
The big issue, you know, that you talked about was, and you continue to advocate for is consolidation of government. The state of Illinois has a lot of districts, let's just put it that way, and
right.
bodies of government. For you, it's important in DuPage County to reduce the size of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big issue here in the state of Illinois and the county of DuPage. Look, we have some, you know, maybe as many as 8,500 units of local government in the state of Illinois, over 400 individual taxing bodies in DuPage County alone. And we know from studying this issue that there is a direct correlation between simply the number of units of local government and property taxes. So it shouldn't be any surprise to anybody that the taxpayer in the state of Illinois pays the highest property tax rate in the country right now, according to the latest studies.
What I find interesting is that it's easier said than done. I mean, obviously, those districts and those bodies of government want to keep the people that are involved in that, want to keep their jobs, and they want to keep their area. But how do you go about reducing the size of government? What can you do at the board to make that a reality?
Well, that's a great question, because it is a awesome issue with a lot of moving parts. I mean, just the magnitude of it, you could spend your entire lifetime and really accomplish very little. So we look at and try to develop strategies where we are sort of changing some foundations, some sort of, you know, a trajectory, if you will, some new tools that the state legislature can pass to give to local governments where we can start to turn this thing around. You know, we didn't get 8,455 units of local government overnight. It took, you know, maybe as long as, you know, 100 years to get to this point. I mean, it goes back to a scheme of laws that were established in different times for different circumstances. I always sort of say, you know, the best way to kind of take a big picture view of this issue is if you had a magic wand and you could wave it over the state of Illinois and the county of DuPage and you could wipe the slate clean, that, you know, there's going to get rid of all these 8,500 units of government and start over. It was your job to start over, to redesign local government in the state of Illinois. Would you set it up the way it is now? And I think the answer is obviously no. So the challenge for us is, how do we get to that? That's your question. So I believe incremental. I started out with a bill that was, you know, we stood alone when we proposed a bill a few years ago. There was nobody else much interested in consolidation. It was a tough fight, but I was given unprecedented authority to consolidate or dissolve some 13 different units of local government in the county of DuPage. That's where we're starting from. We've dissolved three of them. We've got three more up to bat. You know, and I know people are fixated on the number, and that's important, of course, I talk about it, but it really, at the end of the day, it's about savings to the taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So if we can merge, if we can share services, if we can realize savings and efficiencies, and we can measure those savings, I think we've done a good job. Right now, we can demonstrate conservatively that we have saved over $100 million to the taxpayers through a combination of reforms, accountability, consolidation, transparency. So it really, I think, you know, I mean, I humbly would suggest that I think we're demonstrating that we are a model, if I may say.
And people are paying attention. Governor Rauner has picked up the mantle, at least in rhetoric, about consolidating government. The Better Government Association has weighed in on this issue for years now, that we are, that our state in the United States of America is one of the worst when it comes to the amount of governing bodies that are here. You know, I mentioned in the beginning your motto could be do more with less. You're one of the politicians or lawmakers in our state that recognizes that the budgeting climate is changing, that, you know, we're no longer in a situation where we can pay for everything. So we have to start thinking differently about how we run local government. What do you mean by that?
Look, it's no secret that these are really, really difficult and challenging times. Just, you know, look, you need to look no further than Springfield, but it's happening all across the nation. Look at, you know, Congress and Washington. These are really, really tough times. There's you know, lots of need. There's limited resources. The economy has been, you know, kind of stuck and fits and starts. And I think when and if the legislature, and it will eventually happen, when they get a budget, there will be a new normal that will emerge. And it isn't going to be more money for local government. It's going to be less. I think we're going to be called upon to be more efficient. And so seeing that, recognizing that that's on the horizon, we've been busy at work here in DuPage the last couple of years, trying to cut the budget, reducing headcount, you know, engaging in intergovernmental agreements with neighboring units of government, you know, doing joint purchasing, trying to employ all sorts of different strategies. And, you know, a lot of local governments are doing it. There's some smart people in local government that I have followed their lead. So I think this is the new normal. I think we should be prepared for it. It's a little frightening when you look at what could happen. We have a couple of different budget scenarios that we have employed. We have one that, we, you know, what we think is going to happen, what's likely to happen, what's possible to happen. And it's a little scary, to be honest with you.
Well, how do you balance when you're talking about a robust economy or a DuPage County that's in the black? How do you balance that with cutting heads when people are, you know, employed and essentially to save money, you're cutting jobs? How do you balance that as a lawmaker?
Well, I mean, I don't take delight in you know, when you say you reduce headcount, we've been able to accomplish that primarily through attrition. We've done it, you know, and given notice to our supervisors and our department heads to say, look, we think we're going to go in a little different direction. You know, don't hire some folks. Let's sort of employ this new direction, this new policy. I don't take delight in that. But I guess if you believe in the philosophy, as I do, that less government, lower taxes provides for a more robust economy and jobs, you know, and so taxpayer savings. If $100 million in savings, that's $100 million that we can repurpose for things that we don't have to raise taxes for. We haven't raised property taxes here in 6 years. We have a AAA bond rating. So we're meeting the needs, we're fulfilling our responsibility, and we're keeping it all within our budget without raising taxes. That allows folks to, you know, put more money in their college savings accounts. That allows people to go out and, you know, maybe buy a new car. So you have to keep your eye on the big picture, keeping costs low, taxes low, smaller government. I believe, I adopt the philosophy that actually provides people an opportunity to be more upwardly mobile, to get a better job and to get a higher paycheck. So you have to keep your eye on the big picture.
We're talking with DuPage County Chair Dan Cronin. You know, it's interesting because all the things you talk about in DuPage County and the trends that you're moving towards with smaller government and reducing the tax burden, they're almost in sharp contrast with what's happening to your neighbor, the city of Chicago. The city of Chicago having a lot of trouble with their rating, borrowing. You know, we're seeing less and less revenue, but not finding much to cut. So how does that affect you? Because, you know, it's all an ecosystem here where all of the counties are kind of connected. And Chicago obviously is the big economic engine that pushes things. How does that affect when a municipality like or a city like Chicago is having financial trouble?
Well, there's no doubt. As Chicago goes, so goes the region. And, you know, Chicago is a vitally important part of, I think, the DuPage County experience. And I would argue that DuPage County is an important part of the whole Chicago experience. There's no doubt that there is all sorts of interrelationships. And so, you know, we work with the city of Chicago. We're trying to work on some economic development opportunities up and near and around O'Hare. I've had a wonderful working relationship with Toni Preckwinkle. I think she's been a very good leader in Cook County. You know, look, at different regions have some different challenges. I would argue, though, that the DuPage County really is changing. You know, we've been fortunate in many ways, but look at, you know, our poverty rates are dramatically increasing. Our senior population is growing. The demand on government services is greater and greater. And so while we become more efficient, it comes at a time when there's more stress and strain put on government. So working with the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, in Chicago, and working with Toni Preckwinkle is really vitally important. important in this day and age. I kind of remember when I was in the legislature years ago, it was popular to play this, you know, DuPage against Chicago and DuPage against Cook. And those were the kind of the political games that went on. And you know, I mean, it served, I guess, some sort of political purpose back then. But the world has changed. I think people expect us to work together. We have regional problems. Had a very good meeting with Mayor Rahm Emanuel recently. We talked at length about the heroin problem.
Yeah.
It's a regional issue. It's dramatic. It's tragic. And we're working together to address that in a meaningful way. So, look, the world's changed. We got to change with it.
Let me ask you, you know, I mean, that's well said. And it also, you know, prompts the next question about the state budget standstill. The two parties are still don't have an agreement on a budget, Governor Rauner and Speaker Madigan. You were down in Springfield for 20 years. To see this happening at the stalemate and for it to go along as, I mean, to record length here, what's your take on it? And, you know, what can we do as citizens and taxpayers in this state to help make this happen?
Well, it has been difficult to watch. And the County of DuPage, we have a very important vested interest, no doubt. I mean, you know, there's, you know, DuPage County is owed roughly $1 million in state funding right now. The biggest unpaid bill for us out in DuPage is child support enforcement. So, you know, as our budget season developed, we planned for some of the holes in the state funding. We produced a conservative budget, as I mentioned earlier. I look at what has been going on down there, and it is very disturbing. I do recognize, though, there seems to be some light lately. There seems to be some movement among the rank and file legislators. I think there's a little bit of, you know, some of the folks that may have been around for a while, they're kind of asserting themselves, getting together, meeting, talking. You know, we saw, you know, we avoided this crisis, short-term funding infusion for higher ed. You know, look, Governor Rauner is a very passionate man. He has demonstrated his commitment and his you know, his civic, you know, responsibility. He's been really involved in education. He's been a huge philanthropist. He really, really believes in what he's doing, and he believes there needs to be structural change in the way business is done in Springfield. And, you know, Speaker Madigan, on the other side, some of those structural changes go right to the very heart of what the Speaker believes is the foundation to the Democratic Party and you know, trade unions and some of the prevailing wage and things like that. So it's unfortunate, but I think we can find common ground. And I think it's taken some time, but I think the governor has demonstrated his resolve and the speaker has certainly conveyed his commitment to his constituencies. And so I'm hopeful that there's going to be some movement. We'll see some things happening very soon. You know, I think those of us out in the hinterlands, like in DuPage County, I've made my point clear. We need a budget. We need to get this thing done. And I'd love to see some structural reform as well.
Chairman Cronin, I got to ask you about the Illinois Republican primary that we just had in March. Republicans voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. And Donald Trump looks
frightening.
For you being, you know, a part of the real GOP bastion in the state of Illinois, that being on the DuPage County Board, being a Republican that, you know, has served the state of Illinois. What do you think of Donald Trump and him being the nominee? And is the party going to push for him?
You know, I've really been conflicted and troubled. I am, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm old school or something, but I believe that that politics and compromise and, you know, incremental reform and respecting other people's viewpoints and, you know, moving the ball down the field. You know, I mean, I think that's how you govern. And I think you use measured language. And I think you invite, you know, people who may be on the outs and people who are not part of the mainstream in the society, you invite them to be part of it. It's a business of addition. And so I think the politics has evolved. It's become much more, you know, confrontational, and it's disturbing to me. I'm a big boy. I can handle it. But I just think that, you know, you look at the trends and this confrontational politics doesn't really get us better product. We don't really have a more well well-functioning Congress or legislatures, you know. And so I'm a Republican, but I also have principles, and I would expect that he would evolve and adjust his views and positions on things. I'd like to see that happen. And so that remains to be seen as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, we'll check back with you in August and see what you think of that.
Yeah, sure.
DuPage County Board Chairman Dan Cronin joins us tonight. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
It's the download here on WGN Radio. All the show goes to 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we're going to talk about the philosophy around voting. Heard so many different people say now with Trump and Clinton, you know, I'm just going to sit this election out. We'll talk with our resident philosopher about how voting came to be, why voting's important. And not just sort of like, you know, that civil thing where we're like, or civic thing where we're, oh, you got to go, you have to vote. Just a little bit more to understand why we vote. So we'll talk with Professor Al Genie coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And we'll also talk about fantasy sports. Regulations are winding their way through the Illinois House. Sites like FanDuel and DraftKings will soon have license and taxes and everything else. But what happens to the smaller businesses that run fantasy leagues? Are they going to be taxed out of the game? We'll find out about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Joining me tonight, now, at the big table, is a frequent guest here on the download, but we've never had him here in Chicago. Rich Cohen has a new book out called The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. It's a story of a young Rich Cohen who was once assigned by Rolling Stone magazine to follow the Stones and write about them. He learned much more about the band than just the music. It's a great story about what makes a band like this tick and if the band is actually that anymore. Cohen was such a part of the experience that Jagger recruited him to work and write with Martin Scorsese on the HBO series Vinyl, which just wrapped up their first season. Rich is a local product, and he's authored several books, including Monsters, the story of the 85 Bears, and he works for all sorts of publications like Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and, of course, Rolling Stone. Rich Cohen, welcome to the download. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great – I kind of want to start the story chronologically and talk about Honky Tonk Woman. And talk about your experience. There's a great passage in this book about, you know, sort of sneaking up to your older brother's room.
Well, I'm like, you know, the typical little brother. Everything's from the point of view of a little brother. And I grew up in Glencoe, and I have a brother 5 years older than me. And at a certain age, he moved up to the attic, which is like he moved to the frontier. You know, there's no law. He could do whatever he wanted up there. And he had this incredible stereo, and I was not allowed up to his room ever. And I was sitting in my room, and I heard, and all my records were like, I don't know. The best record I had was Rhinestone Cowboy. They were nuts, hardcore records. Right. And I heard the intro to that song, Honky Tonk Woman. It kind of lifted me out of my bedroom and carried me into his room and up the stairs. And I feel like it kind of called me into a new life. It completely changed my life. And I became like a Rolling Stones fanatic very early. And unbelievably, you know, people say that this book is like almost famous.
Yeah.
And it kind of is. You know, I talked to Cameron Crowe about it after I wrote it. But it's kind of like this is the Rolling Stones. And this isn't just, I don't know what almost famous. This is the greatest rock and roll band in history. And in chronological time, very soon after I first heard that song, went off to college. I came out of college and I came to New York and I got a job at Rolling Stone. A lot of stuff happened. But very early on when I was 25.
Yeah.
I got a call from my editor, said, what are you doing this summer? I said, I don't know, what's going on? He said, can you go to Toronto and sort of hang out with the Rolling Stones? I'm like, okay.
Yeah, sure.
No problem.
Like today, now. Yeah. Well, what I loved about it, setting that up, was a passage in the book that, you know, when you sat down with the editor, people who worked at the magazine told you, you know, if he asks you who your favorite band is, don't tell him for real because he'll never assign you to
right.
cover that band.
Well, this was Jan Wenner, who's sort of figure in his own right, who started Rolling Stone. I was working at a little newspaper, and I remember I got a call. Jan wants to meet you. Can you come in for a meeting right now? I'm like, oh, God, look, I'm dressed like garbage, man. And I remember I had a shirt that didn't have buttons on, and my friend took my sleeve and stapled my sleeve shut. And I walked over to his office, and my editor came in. He said, listen, Jan's going to ask you who you want to write about more than anyone in the world. Don't tell him the truth. because whatever you tell him, he'll never give you that assignment. So I wanted to write about the Rolling Stones. So he said, who do you want to write about? I said, I want to write Bob Dylan. He said, that's great.
That's great.
And that's the only assignment I never got at Rolling Stones.
Never, never. We'll give you something secondary, the Rolling Stones. All right, so let's catch back up. So in Toronto, you show up. What I love about, and I kind of tease this out when talking to Ro and Anna at the crosstalk for the shows, is, you know, you'd think, okay, you get to Toronto and you're going to have a night's sleep and then you're going to catch up and there's going to be a traditional sort of itinerary that's given to you. But it's very rock and roll in the way that they're like, are you ready? You just landed? Great. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Let's go.
Right. Well, the first thing to say is I went to Central School in Glencoe and I had a gym teacher named Don Kreitzer who used to make you do like 15 push-ups for being a smart ass and run laps and everything. So I got the thing to run to go up to Toronto. And I get to my hotel, which is a Harbor Castle hotel, where Keith Richards had been busted for heroin not very long before. And I asked him, how can you be back here? He said, if I didn't go wherever they had busted me, I couldn't go to any city in the world, basically. And I unpack and getting ready to go to sleep. It's like 10 o'clock at night. And Keith's manager comes over and says, let's go see him. I said, what's up? He said, they're rehearsing right now. Let's go see him. And these guys, to me, seemingly were like 50 years old. They were like older than I am now, but they rehearsed from like about midnight until 7 in the morning. And they took me in a car over to a junior high school, basically, in the outskirts of Toronto, totally deserted, nothing scarier than a deserted, you know, junior high school, and into the gym, which is like, I'm looking for Mr. Kreitzer. It's like I'm back in the gym. And what's going on in the gym would drive Mr. Kreitzer insane. The Rolling Stones have set up their stuff, and they're playing the loudest rock and roll you've ever heard. And you can hear it echoing through all the – and all I can think about is the kids, man. The kids who are away for the summer have no idea what's going on in
their idea
school.
That these guys are up there figuring out their set lists. They're rehearsing. I mean, they're on stage. All the guys are talking to each other. They're trying to figure out what song should we play next. And the only people in the room are the engineer and you.
Right, and the Rolling Stones. And what's kind of cool about it was what they would do is – they would start talking and someone would yell out a song like, let's try Memory Motel, you know, let's try When the Whip Comes Down. And the engineer would actually get the CD out and play it. And they would listen to it and play over it. And Ron Wood is writing down the chords because some of these aren't even his songs.
Right.
And they play it through again over the CD and then they play it on their own and they give it like two or three times. And if it's good and they like it, then they write it on a board and they go on. And one of the coolest things I saw that always gave me an idea about how the Rolling Stones work, which is Keith Richards drives the rhythm of that band, is they played, I forgot what song it was, but they start and they're playing and Charlie Watts, the drummer, is 200 yards away making himself tea.
He starts up there and then it's like whenever they want to join in,
they're so comfortable with each other. Yeah, and just sort of sits down.
It's their office day job. I mean, they've done this for so long. They rehearse how they want to, it's a shorthand.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for you to be in that room, I mean, and this is really getting at the idea of thinking about your brother's room upstairs and then being in this, on the outskirts of town, this junior high school in Toronto. With you and the Rolling Stones, I mean, was it hard not to have an out-of-body experience?
Yeah, and actually, that's where the title comes from, which is I was interviewing Keith Richards, who's like sitting in this chair, a big velvet chair, like in a leopard skin robe, and he's got a doctor's bag he's carrying with him everywhere. And he looks at me and he goes, tell me what ails you, because in here I got a cure for everything, you know? and at one point, I'm asking him questions, and he's sort of, and I'm nervous, and I'm 26. And by the way my questions are going, he's confused. He goes, wait a second, what year were you born? I go, 1968, which now doesn't make me so young, but then did. And he just started to laugh. And he goes, you know what? I should be asking you questions. You tell me. I have no idea what it's like for you. There's always been the sun and the moon and the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. Rich Cohen, the book is The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Let's take a quick break, come back. You know, one of the things that came out of this book, which was fascinating for me, was the relationship between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. I mean, we talk so much in our pop culture world about Lennon and McCartney and the duos and how bands sort of surround themselves around the two egos in a band. Well, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were no different. We'll talk more about that with Rich Cohen when we return here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, author Rich Cohen. He's back in Chicago. He's the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, talking about his unbelievable assignment. And boyhood fan of the Rolling Stones, and he got a chance at an early age writing for Rolling Stone magazine to follow the band. And this really chronicles not only that story, but the history. I mean, you get into a lot of different interviews with people that surrounded the band members, about the history. And you say it in the book. I mean, this isn't the first biography of or historical account of the Rolling Stones. There are hundreds.
Yeah, no.
Why go about putting together a definitive historical account of this band?
Well, I feel like when there's a lot of books about one thing, it's often because it's never really been gotten. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when you really get something, the books kind of stop for a while. And the reason is because the Rolling Stones, most of the really good books about them were written by guys who are kind of their contemporaries, their age, who were often writers for Rolling Stone in the middle of the real craziness, right in the middle of it. And they had no perspective to get the big picture. And maybe it's because of my age, but I kind of felt like this music, and not just the Rolling Stones, but rock and roll was so important to me. Waiting for records, it kind of gave my life a kind of meaning. It was a kind of religion for me when I was a kid. And I felt like it kind of died.
Yeah.
It died while I was working at Rolling Stone. You felt it die.
This would be like the late 90s.
Yeah, I felt when Kurt Cobain killed himself, that was kind of it. That was kind of it, in a way. And for that kind of vitality, and probably the computer and the MP3 and all these different things. And I felt like rock and roll, that kind of rock and roll had died, and nobody had stepped back and written the story. And I felt like I could write the story, man. I could write the big story of rock and roll, what it meant, what mm-hmm. it felt like, why it was so important. And I can use the Rolling Stones as the way to tell that story, because they're the greatest rock and roll band. They're the only one that survived. They're right. The only one still playing. And they're guys I actually happen to have worked with and know and have all this experience with.
What I love about the book, too, is it's not just this glowing, love letter to the Rolling Stones. I mean, you're critical of the band. You count the band now, the band that has been in the current last couple decades, seems to be phoning it in, or it's more commerce than it is rock and roll, that they changed somewhere along the line. And, you know, this is not about the love of the music. This is about business.
Right. Well, sort of when you write a book like this, you have to decide, like, who's your loyalty to? Is your loyalty to the band, or is your loyalty to the reader and the truth? And if it's to the latter, it has a chance to be a better book, and it might piss some people off. And probably the more people it pisses off, maybe the better it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, you know, the Rolling Stones, it's sort of like they, at a certain moment, they were at the avant-garde, and they were the cutting edge, and they lost that. And the question, and that's not that, they had a stretch of four records where they were the best ever, maybe the best four records in a row ever, the greatest rock band ever. And it's not unusual that you can't keep up that pace. No one's ever done it. And if you look at great artists, they probably, most of them will have a stretch like that. And that's sort of typical. But the question is, why did they fall apart? What was the last great record? Did they break up? And for me, who was kind of in some ways a lonely kid, you know, with a lot of friends but still kind of lonely, it's sort of like the Rolling Stones were like a gang. And what was so great about them is you felt like you could be in this gang, man. You could be part of this thing. And for me personally, I get into the gang and I get into the room and the two leaders of the gang hate each other. Completely depressing.
Let's talk about, I mean, that's the root of maybe the current or modern day troubles of the Rolling Stone, was the relationship between lead singer Mick Jagger and guitarist Keith Richards. You know, being there and seeing them, you kind of categorize them in a fun way, where Richards is the passion and Jagger is the show. How would you say it?
Well, they're like the prototypical rock band. So Richards literally is like the rhythm, man. He plays the rhythm guitar, he sets the rhythm of the songs, and he kind of creates the floor in the world. And Jagger is like the kind of dancing ray of light moving all around the stage. He is literally the front man. He is in front. He stands for the band. He's the voice of the band. He's hugely important. That's a big thing, which is when they went off on their own, they're less apart than they are together. They are a great, great rock band.
Well, why don't we start with what makes them work? You know, we'll talk about what doesn't, why they hate each other. But what made Mick Jagger and Keith Richards work when they were at the height of the Rolling Stones?
Well, they met when they were kids, when they were little kids. They knew each other when they were 6 years old. And they both fell in love with this kind of music, which was Chicago music. It was Chess Records. Jagger was sending away to Marshall Chess, who was growing up in Glencoe and working at Ricky's Delicatessen, and his part-time job filling out orders from Michael Jagger from Dartford, England, and sending him records, okay? And then Jagger has these records on the at the train station in Dartford and runs into Keith Richards, and he says, what are those? And they're Chuck Berry records and Muddy Water records, and they get together and they start playing these records. And just because they're not Chuck Berry and they're not Muddy Waters, they change the songs as they attempt to copy them, creating something new. They kind of mess them up with their own personality, and then they come back to Chicago, and they kind of bring Chicago's music back to Chicago. I always say the longest road from the north, south side of Chicago to the north side went through England, you know, because that's how this music wound up. And they really started out as collectors. And they met Brian Jones. There was a little club in England called the Ealing Club, which was open just for this kind of music. Jagger and Richards went in one night and they saw this blonde-haired guy playing slide guitar. It was mm-hmm. Brian Jones. They were completely blown away. They started this band, originally called Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys, then became the Rolling Stones, then became the Rolling Stones. And they were just the greatest bar band you've ever seen in your life. And that kind of was their ultimate. When people, I knew a lot of people who saw them then. 1962, 1963, in the basement clubs in London, jammed in with kids their age, just playing Little Red Rooster or mm-hmm. I Just Want to Make Love to You or whatever the song was. And the energy of that kind of drove their entire careers, and that's what made them. It was the yin and the yang of those two guys playing with each other and playing against each
other. As they got bigger and obviously took off, I mean, there was a struggle with them about who the leader of the band was. I mean, there was always, when Jagger went into solo work, you know, Keith Richards was critical, you know, like there was same right. the other way around. But there always was a struggle about who was running this band.
Well, their original leader was Brian Jones. He was the best musician. It was his sound. When you listen to those early Stones records and you hear anything strange, it's him. It's his slide guitar, him playing the recorder, you know. And he really chose a set list and he spoke, and it was Brian Jones's band. And that was how it was in the little clubs with blues fans. But when they got bigger, people naturally started to identify, especially girls, with Mick Jagger
right.
because he was the one who was singing. He was the one you looked at. You look at the singer. And that drove Brian Jones crazy. And then the other thing that happened was you had to start writing your own music, because that's what Bob Dylan did and that's what the Beatles did.
Because they were doing covers at that point, a lot of blues stuff.
All their first songs were covers.
Yeah.
And their first hit was a cover, was Little Red Rooster. And it was they started writing their own songs. Now, their manager was this guy, Andrew Lou Goldham, who was actually younger than them. He was like 17 years old. And he said to them, you have to write your own music. And he was living with them. So one of the reasons why it's Jagger Richards is just because they were the ones around. If Jagger had been living with Brian Jones, maybe right. it would have been Jagger Jones. They weren't like Paul McCartney and John Lennon, who sort of you feel like no matter when they would have lived, they would have written these songs, because they were completely melodic songwriters, almost like Broadway songwriters. These guys had to learn how to write songs for the right. Rolling Stones, and they're really driven by the groove, and you see how they worked together, and it was sort of fascinating, because usually Keith Richards would write the riff, like the four notes, and then the phrase, and then give it to Jagger, who'd write the rest. So he'd write, you know, he wrote Satisfaction, he wrote the riff, and he wrote Can't Get No Satisfaction, which Jagger always claimed came from actually a Chuck Berry song where he sings, I can't get no satisfaction from the judge. And then he gave it to Jagger, who filled in everything else, and then bam, it became a hit. So it was pure collaboration. So if those guys aren't friends, aren't collaborating, the
right.
music ends.
Well, let's take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll get into the darker days of the two. I guess the breakup. I mean, the breakup is interpretive, but we'll talk about the Rolling Stones. The book is called The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. The author is Rich Cohen. We'll talk more with Rich after the break. Stay with us. This is Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me at the big table, Rich Cohen. The new book, The Sun, the Moon, and the Rolling Stones. Talk about a great story. It's like a tailor-made story where Rich was a Rolling Stones fan
who got the greatest assignment in the world to cover the Rolling Stones for Rolling Stone magazine. This is really the story of that, and also sort of chronicles the life of the Rolling Stones. You know, one of the things I loved about the book, like we talked about a little bit earlier, you are critical in some ways. You know, going to see the Rolling Stones at the Superdome.
Right.
You know, was sort of, that was when it kind of pops up at the beginning. You kind of, you sum up the Rolling Stones as I kind of know them.
Right. Well, at some point, it's like they almost became a kind of oldies act, you know? And I felt like at the beginning of their career, they were imitating people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Chuck Berry. And by the time I was seeing them in college, they were imitating themselves as they had been 15 years earlier. You know, and you sort of like, I always said, you don't really know what an oldies act is, but it's like the that definition of pornography, like you know it when you see it, mm-hmm. you know? And it just wasn't alive in the same way. And I had been into the Rolling Stones and as a really young kid, I always said I was like the kid singing Mother's Little Helper, but I had no idea what that song meant, you know? And then later on, I kind of moved on to other music. But I always kind of had this special place for the Rolling Stones. It's like your first love, your first kind of girlfriend. And
what I really loved about it, though, is that later in that assignment, I think it was a different assignment, you got a chance to see them play in a bar. I think it was back in Toronto, right? Where they actually got to...
Right, well, that's what happened, which is I saw them in the Superdome, and it's like completely diffused, man. It doesn't work. And it's like you could be seeing a Bears game.
And that's how most people see the Rolling Stone these days, right?
Right, yeah. And then I saw them in this gym, and that's pretty incredible. But then just before they went out on tour, they did a little surprise gig in a little tiny bar in Toronto called the Macomba Lounge, I think, which is named after the original Chess Records. And it was, you know, like a place that held like 300-400 people, and half of them just people drinking, and suddenly the Rolling Stones are playing. And you're like, oh my God, this is the Rolling Stones. I mean, this is what the guys are talking about at the Ealing Club in England. This is what they're built for. They're a little bar band. Wow. They're a little engine. They all need to be pressed together. They need to be jammed up close. So when people tell me, oh yeah, I went to see the Rolling Stones, you know, and they weren't that great. I saw them in Soldier Field. I'm like, you didn't see the Rolling Stones. I mean, the Rolling Stones exist in a bar, and they exist at 2 a.m. when you're drunk. You know, and Keith has found the groove, and Mick has remembered who he really is. That's the Rolling Stones.
So for you, I really like when the article came out, the Rolling Stone article, when you were 25, 26 years old, you got a note from Mick Jagger's publicist. It's like, I think you got this article wrong. It says On the Road with the Rolling Stones, but it should be called I Love Keith Richards. I want to marry Keith Richards or whatever it was. You don't hold back. You actually identify more with Keith Richards than a Mick Jagger.
Well, I do and I don't. I mean, I don't think Keith Richards, you can sort of like, there's like, if you ever saw the movie The Sure Thing, like Keith Richards is like your pal Nick, man. He's your buddy. You can throw up in his car and everything. That's like Keith Richards. You can not really know him and very quickly feel like you know him and pal around with him. Mick Jagger is mercurial. I worked with him, you know, as a co-writer, and you feel like you know him, but you never really know him. And an example is when I interviewed him. When I first interviewed him, I was taping him, and as he's talking, I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting such a scoop here. I'm getting unbelievable stuff. It's like going to change the world. No one's ever gotten this kind of stuff. And I get it transcribed, and it's nothing. There's nothing there. It's like he said a lot of words, but he said nothing. And that's his genius. Keith, I couldn't understand what he said. He was like mumbling. I was leaning in. I couldn't hear anything. That got transcribed by a really good transcriber with good headphones, and it was genius, man. Everything was gold. You know, so that was sort of the difference. But after that first story came out, that was published. And then I went back on the road with them. Now on the tour, I met them again in the course of the summer. And you immediately could tell they're in two different camps. They have nothing to do with each other. Jagger and Richards, at that point, weren't talking
to each
other.
This is what? This would be...
96, okay. I think. 96, 98. And, you know, you don't really hang out with Mick Jagger before the show. It's just he's alone. He's in his own space. He's like... the great Pavarotti's going out to sing. He's got a voice coach. Whereas Keith Richards, he sits in what they call the guitar room with Ron Wood, and they just drink Jack Daniels, smoke cigarettes, dip into that medical bag I told you about, and play old Hank Williams tunes and joke around, you know? And in the distance, you can sort of hear Jagger going through his scales, and they're, like, laughing at him. You know, they're laughing at the scales. So it's, like, really very – it's sort of intense, but it's – right away, you sort of are in that camp.
Were you surprised by that? Were you, as a writer, that there was that much kind of animosity between the two?
Yeah, I was. If I'd done a lot of research, maybe I wouldn't have been. I realized that tension, it very common in these kind of bands. And I mean, this is just a primo example of it. And weirdly, out of that tension is the soap opera that makes the band so interesting, and also is a lot of the tension that's the music, and then it winds up being what a lot of the songs are even about. But you don't realize it because at some point their fame sealed them off from the world, so their material became their kind of own rock star lives.
For you, I mean, you were did a good job enough, and they didn't feel like you sabotaged them in any way, that you were able to work with Mick Jagger. And he introduced you to Marty Scorsese, and you were able to co-create the show Vinyl, which is on HBO, which is about the rise and fall of a record executive in this time. I mean, it's very Rolling Stones-like in the way that it's presented. Talk about that experience, because for you as a young writer, I mean, a little bit older when you got to do this, but I mean, you're now writing screenplays with Marty Scorsese and Mick Jagger, and they almost chose you because you didn't have experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's like, you know, one of the people I got to know later on was Hunter S. Thompson, you know, patron saint of Rolling Stone, and he had this expression, gonzo. And everyone knows the word, but not everyone knows what it means, which is explained to me by him, which is gonzo means you learn to fly by falling out of a plane, you know? And that's basically, that's rock and roll, and that's what writing about rock and roll in a way should be. And that's kind of what Vinyl is. What happened is after I did those stories, Jagger and Scorsese wanted to make a movie about the rock and roll business, about a rock and roll executive who's also living kind of the rock and roll lifestyle, just like the musicians, you know? And I got hired for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which is I'd gotten to know Jagger. I'd been on the road with them.
They trusted you. They knew you knew the story.
We clicked. Yep. Everything was cool. I'd written this book called Tough Jews about Jewish gangsters in Brooklyn in the 1930s. Scorsese read it and really liked it. It was kind of had the voice of Goodfellas in my head, so there's no reason why he liked it. I was copying him in a way, you know? He liked himself.
I like that. I liked it a lot.
And I'd done a bunch of, and in working at Rolling Stone, I'd already interviewed a bunch of these old legendary music guys who started the business. So they hired me, and basically my job with them was to create the world, create the characters. And I tried to do it by going around and interviewing guys like Ahmet Erdogan, you know, Jerry Wexler, the guys who built, you know, the record business. And in the old days in Brooklyn, there was a big overlap between them and the gangsters because that's who financed a lot of those businesses. And that became even a much longer relationship than the stories in Rolling Stone, because I think I worked on that for 10 years with Jagger.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, 10 years of going into Mick Jagger's apartment or Marty Scorsese's place and you guys hanging out for a couple hours, throwing ideas against the wall. I mean, that's like, again, I go back to that idea of being in that gym in Toronto. Did you have an out-of-body experience with these two legends where they're counting on you to bring your expertise as a writer to the game?
Absolutely, and really with Scorsese, because, first of all, we mostly worked at his house, which is on the Upper East Side of New York, and his office, which is also on the Upper East Side, and he would like have an idea and say, oh, you should see this movie. You know, like you'd say to a friend, oh, you should see this movie. And the next day you get a call from, you know, the screener, okay, Marty's screening the movie, what time are you going to be here? And you sit in the movie theater in his house or in his office by yourself with a guy, and you have to go to the bathroom, and you kind of get up and sneak out like in a movie, and they hear the projectionist go, hey, should I shut off the movie or what? You know, but the thing with him was, like you said, which is, I'd never written a screenplay before. I was a journalist. And he said, good, because I'm not really going to teach you how to write a movie because most movies suck. I'm going to teach you how to write a Marty Scorsese movie. And that's really what he spent a lot of time doing. And it was, you know, just on a personal level, it was an incredible experience for me. And it was like you're so focused on doing a good job.
I was going to say that, the insecurities of being around such legends in both music and movies and saying, am I doing a good job?
Right.
Is this what you want?
But Scorsese especially, because he's so into making you feel like, oh my God, that's the funniest thing in the world. You know, you realize that there's a lot of people that are really creative and smart like that. They're so good at making you feel good about yourself in some way that it actually gets the best out of you. You feel kind of like, hey man, I'm on an incredible role here. You know, so that was like several years of that. And you know, it was awesome. And even Jagger, like Jagger had one great note about the screenplay that became Vinyl, because he said, you know, all this stuff is great, but the thing you are missing, maybe you should remember, is that it was funny. You know, everybody writes about those days like it was high drama and it was Altamont and it was the Hell's Angels. And what everyone doesn't realize is it was funny, man. We were kids and we were having a really fun
right.
time. And all this stuff was a joke and we were laughing all the time. And that's missing from all of this. And then I realized, God, this movie's kind of a comedy.
That's, yeah, it's wonderful. Rich Cohen, the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, also the co-creator of Vinyl on HBO, which just wrapped up its first season. Let's take a last break here. We'll come back and wrap up our conversation with Rich here at the Big Table. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Rich Cohen's at Big Table tonight, the author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, talking about his unbelievable, surreal experience of being a young journalist for Rolling Stone magazine and getting to cover the Rolling Stones and the history of this. It's surreal. It's surreal for you to be a fan of this band and be able to do this, to then take it to the next step and write a book about it. And be involved with Mick Jagger on Vinyl. I mean, what does that mean to you? I mean, as not just a writer, but as a fan of this band.
Well, it's almost like when I started going back and getting into this and reading other books, I'm like, why did I never write about this before? I mean, and then I realized partly because the relationship didn't end and the experience continued. And it's like, I'm sort of like a big believer, like you have to put the glass down and let all the dirt settle at the bottom before you can actually see what the water looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like the end of a chapter of my life in a way, because this, I feel like I stepped back and I could see the entire thing. And the part of my life that was really all about chasing these bands, which went from like age 10 or 11 until I was like 40 years old. And that was really the center of that was the Rolling Stones. So it's, you know, a little melancholy in a way, you know, because when you, after the weird thing about writing about something is kind of you write about it and then you're kind of out of it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's good, and but it's there's a slight melancholy to it, I'd say.
You know, I thought about this when I was reading this book, that, you know, Monsters was the same way. Some of the stuff we talked to you about, the New York Times piece about going around the lake we talked about last summer, even the Cubs stuff that you wrote about. You know, it's how it relates to you as a child. It's the way that you write. You seem to find these relatable things that we know, these big ticket things, whether it be the Cubs or the Rolling Stones. And you're able to write about it through the lens of growing up with it. You know, is that intentional for you in these pieces? I mean, it seems to be sort of your hallmark.
I think, like, when you're a kid, you have the right idea and you know what you like. And when you get older, you don't know what you like and you have to try to figure out what you like and you end up doing stuff you don't really like. I don't know how many times I'm doing stuff and I'm like, you know, I don't even like this. I'm in the middle of it. But when you're a kid, that doesn't happen. You know what you like. And it's like the only time you're ever really at home is when you're a kid. And the rest of your life, you're kind of in exile from being a kid. That's how I feel like. So the stuff that interested me when I was 10, 12, 15, that's the real stuff, man. That's like the really good, pure, deep stuff. And that's the kind of stuff I want to write about.
Is that why we all go watch the Rolling Stones? Is that why we all pay top dollar to go see the Soldier Field, because it reminds us of a different place or something that was more, that was pure in our life?
Yeah, and think about it. Everybody wants the music that it was on the radio when they were 15, okay? And most bands have one song like that, and you go back, and that's the band of your youth. The Rolling Stones have had so many different peaks that they were on the radio when basically everybody was 15 at some point. So they have this massive audience because they kept reinventing themselves, you know, as a pop band, as a psychedelic band, as kind of almost a punk band, as a disco band. And they had all these different peaks. So there's so many different generations' childhood. And I always say, like, most bands live and die once. The Stones have lived and died so many times that they might as well be immortal.
Is there, I mean, it's hard to say, and this is maybe a really cliche question, but will we ever see the Rolling Stones again? As, I mean, because like you said, I mean, they're able to reinvent themselves every 5 years, which, you know, as I said, that's how they have to be if they're going to be successful in pop music.
Right. And they had this manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, who said, you have to reinvent yourself every 5 years because that's how long it takes a kid to go from basically the middle of high school till now he's working. And there's a new crop of kids and they want their own music. So you have to become a new band for that new group of kids. And the key ingredient of the Rolling Stones and the reason why they've lasted so long more than anything else is Mick Jagger. And everybody, you know, kind of busts on him. People like Keith and this, that, and the other. But Jagger's been so determined, level-headed, driven them on, that they would have broken up. They did break up, really, in the late 70s, early 80s. And they would have broken up in the 60s, and they would have broken up in the 70s, and they would have stopped playing together just like every other, just like the Beatles. But they didn't, because there's something unbelievably driven and about Jagger. And he's kept them going and made them, you know, to the fact that they're just playing in Cuba. They're the first rock band to go and play in Havana.
And again, they're a bunch of firsts. They're the first with this band. Well, it's a great book, tremendous read, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, not just about author Rich Cohen's experience with them, but also history. I mean, he talked to so many people, and we didn't even get into so many parts. The one part I really wanted to get into, and maybe we could just sum it up quick, is that, you know, there are a lot of people that surround that band, from, you know, girlfriends to common law to wives to band members to equipment managers, and it doesn't always turn out well for people that are involved in the Rolling Stones.
No, I mean, one thing that is a huge, that they have a huge talent for is finding the most talented people of their time and working with them. And they have, the way that you reinvent themselves is they get new people.
Yeah.
And the people that are so important to them are suddenly off the train. And when you're in that circle, especially back in the 60s, it must have been unbelievable. You're at sort of this hot center of the world, you know, and you get all this feeling of self-worth that's borrowed. It's borrowed from Jagger and Richards. And then suddenly you're out. And it's like over.
Yeah.
And those people all wrote books because that was the event of their lives. And it's sort of like the Rolling Stones are just, I think Steel Wheels was a great title of a record for them because they're like a train. And once you're off, it's like you fall off the train, instantly the train's 50, you know, miles away from you, just like that.
So much to learn from this band and the book, The Sun, the Moon, and the Rolling Stones. Rich Cohen, thanks for being my guest tonight. I appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Justin.
Rich Cohen's going to be at Mark Baser's show tomorrow, the interview show at The Hideout, 6:30 start. The Hideout up on 1354 West Wabanzi, if you want to check out. He'll be interviewed by Mark, and I think it's for I believe it's for WTTW, like for be an episode in later time. Rob, are you a fan of the Rolling Stones?
I saw them at the Bell Center in Montreal in 2006, maybe.
How did you like the show?
I loved it, but what was funny is, you know, you go from everybody back in the day holding up their cigarette lighters to holding up the cell phones.
Right.
So that was fun. No, you know, I'll tell you what. Mick Jagger, however old he is now, was unbelievable. And they played for 2.5 hours. They from start to finish, 2.5 hours, no encore, but you certainly got your money's worth.
Well, I will say that, last night we kind of did the What Did We Learn kind of segment at the end of the show. What I learned from that conversation is that Rich nailed it. They have reinvented themselves so many times in their career that they mean something to so many different 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
And that's why when they play Soldier Field, or that's why they've existed so long. That's why they'll play this summer or whenever they play again, and it'll be sold out because there's so many different generations that see them as the band of their childhood.
That's my tremendous. 16-year-old twins, my 6-year-old, my 4-year-old, they all have a favorite Rolling Stones song. So when it comes on the radio, I've got to turn it up.
That's great.
That's fun.
Ah, so good. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, I don't know about you guys, but it seems like every single night I've been complaining about fatigue. And when I talk about fatigue, I'm not talking about the fact that I'm not getting a good night's sleep. I'm talking about primary fatigue. It almost makes you not want to vote. Could this be the election that kills voter interest in the country that is the United States of America? Well, not if you listen to our resident philosopher, Al Genie. He's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University. He joins us regularly here on the show. Al, good to see you. Talk me off the ledge.
I know, and I feel the same way. I'm so tired of the same spiel, the same stump speeches again and again. But I think we're forgetting the real purpose of this whole exercise. That is, to elect a president of the United States. And this is also about, even larger than that, Justin, the right to decide, the right to choose, the right to determine our own fate as a people. I think that's the core issue involved here. All the money being spent, which is absolutely obscene when you start to think about it. But this is not the country of Louis XIV who said, I am the state. Rather, we are the state. The state exists for us. And again, let me quote Lincoln, and let me point out again, I knew him. We weren't that close. You keep thinking that we were that close. Then when Lincoln said, the power of the state is its people, and the people have a right to decide what's going on.
This is a as I said, I mean, this is an election that there's tremendous fatigue because it's just over and over
again,
especially when you talk about Donald Trump. This idea that, can he win? People are actually voting for you. You hear it all the time. But as you point out, this is a country that is of the people, by the people, for the people. If the people want Donald Trump, the people want Donald Trump.
That's the whole premise of democracy here. And I think what we're talking about underlying all this, I think there's a whole other show here about primary politics. How should they be arranged?
Yeah.
How long should they – how much money should
how
be spent?
How they should be funded, right.
Yeah,
right,
how they should be funded, et cetera, et cetera. But what we're really talking about here is universal suffrage in the United States. And certainly it's not without its problems. Certainly we've seen real issues right from the beginning. Our founding fathers set up the Electoral College as a safeguard against the people should they elect the wrong person along the way.
Right.
And then males only can vote. And then there was only landowners can vote. And then there were state literacy tests. And then there was a head tax. My God. And women couldn't vote until 1920.
Now there's an ID law,
right?
It continues.
Those, and you know, women couldn't vote until 1920, as they said, when the 19th Amendment was passed. And 18-year-olds, when you were – that was last year for you.
Yes, it was. I'm 19 and a half,
year.
Right.
In 1971, we finally passed the 25th Amendment. So what we're talking about here, and this is how I feel about it, maybe because my dad served in World War II and my grandfather served in World War I, but on the other side, we don't want to talk about that right now, but in Italy, but fighting for the Allies. And in a real sense, what we're talking about, voting is a duty. And I think not to vote is an abdication of our duty, an abdication of power, an abdication of citizenship, and the abdication of our essential legacy. Our right to choose our own
fate. Do you think when you know, I think about the first election that I voted in, 1992, Bill Clinton versus George H.W. Bush. There was a movement to make it important for me to vote. I mean, MTV was telling me to rock the vote. There was, you know, Bill Clinton going on with saxophone. I think a lot about people who are 18 years old in 2008 with Barack Obama.
Right.
And Hope. Is this generation, the generation of young voters that are coming up, do they feel the same duty? I mean, you mentioned World War II, Vietnam War. I just mentioned, you know, the idea of television telling me to vote. Is that still there? Because
it seems like it's not. It's still there. In some sense, though, people are saying, you know, a plague on both their houses right now. I think older folks, my generation, are saying, well, it's the same old stuff. You know, what batch is this? Younger folks are saying, I'm not involved in this. That's why I think Bernie Sanders and Mr. Trump are intriguing people to come back and say, maybe I can make a difference. But the sad fact is, and this is somewhat appalling, of the recent statistics about people voting, and they're pretty steady. I would love somebody who's into big data to be exact on this. Presidential elections are still only about a 50% turnout of possible electors. Congressional elections are about 40%.
Right.
Primaries have been a little up because people are interested right now. They're about 45%.
Let's not talk about aldermanic. When you get down to the lower levels.
That 6 votes makes you an alderman's very often, right? And the sad reality is in the late 80s, more people bowled every year than voted in congressional elections, you know? And there's some real research on that. And there's a sage warning behind all this. When you don't vote, you get exactly the kind of government you deserve.
That's a great point, because I was going to say, right now you've got this, it seems to be fatigue based on the fact that we've had gridlock, that we've had a Republican Congress and a Democrat president, political powers just kind of going at each other. You've seen that on both sides of the coin, this rejection of the traditional politician.
Right.
Is that, that's playing in, but it also has to do with the fact that the numbers you just mentioned, less than half of the country are actually exercising
their
right to vote.
It seems to me, and I'm trying to read the papers and look at the tea leaves behind the papers, they have this new surge of people voting, but you've had other people drop out. So you still got the same kind of percentage, the same essential percentage. Now, there are a lot of people who said, you know, Donald Trump speaks to me. They've forgotten about me. Of course, every billionaire speaks to a lower middle class person, et cetera, et cetera. It's a strange phenomenon. But you brought this up. Bernie Sanders, in some sense, is a protest candidate. And I think he's really brought something to the table. Democrats thought, well, he would make Hillary more of a populist. He has. There's no doubt about it at all. Here's one question for me, just at raw money. All right, Bernie, you're not going to win now. Let's assume that right now.
Right.
What are you going to do with all that money? What's going to happen
money,
to this? Why do we have to spend all this money in election? There's something wonderful. Now, it's another country, limited number of people, where in England, when there's a vote, it's 90 days, and you can only spend X amount.
And I know you're not a constitutional or electoral scholar.
No, I'm not.
But different countries do it different ways, and there seems to be a premium put on how long the elections are. In this country, we do it for 1 day, but you see in South America, there will be a 2-week window. You know, when you think about all the different ways as a human that we vote, not just in this country, but around. Is this something that, you know, you come in, we talk about philosophy. Is this a philosophical issue?
I think it is a philosophical issue because, again, we fought so hard for the vote, the literal ability to vote. Not to vote says something about not just the actual ballot, the mechanism itself.
Right,
it says
right.
something about us. How we feel about how we should be governed, how people should rule us and run things. And I think a lot of people are just trying to stay below the radar as long as we're okay. It's like in the recession. Upper middle class people did fine. We cruised. Oh, we didn't go out to dinner that extra night that week, you know.
Right.
And so there's always that cadre of people in a society that are not touched. But I think that what we have to look at in regard to voting is, again, if you don't vote, you get the government you deserve in a very real sense. But not to be an intelligent voter is to let other people determine your life, to break the basic philosophical doctrine of Socrates, an unexamined life is not worth living.
If you have the ability to, what is it about group thing?
Yeah.
Is it someone saying, you hear it all the time, my vote doesn't really count. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of votes that are tallied. My
right.
one vote doesn't matter.
Right.
What is it, though, about the idea of us giving up that freedom, giving up that duty?
Because that notion of one vote doesn't count is really true when you're talking about that one vote. But when you have an aggregate of one votes, they do count. I point out to you that there's a great deal of scholarship that says Al Gore should have been president of the United States mm-hmm. because of those chads, those hanging chads, and who voted and who didn't vote
sure.
and how that all turned out. So I think we're talking about is the right of the people to make decision. Now, that's included in voting, but it's also including in the right to protest, which I think is just as sacred as the right to vote.
And you've seen that kind of time and time again together. I mean,
yeah,
voting
they are
protests
together.
Are always together.
And, of course, there's always the dilemma, should it be pacifistic in nature? Should it be more Socratic and based on Gandhi and based on Martin Luther King? Or is violence in the street necessary? But finding the middle position, I think the right to protest is part of our First Amendment rights, that is the freedom of speech, the freedom of press, the freedom of assembly. And we forget it, the First Amendment says the petition of a grievance. So protest is the way that democracies debate publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think protests are really, really important. I mean by that, protests as part of due process. I'm not talking about hate speech,
yeah.
But I think it's connected to our notion of freedom of speech. But of course, the caveat of freedom of speech, as Oliver Wendell Holmes says, you cannot yell fire in a crowded auditorium.
But isn't protest, because we're going to, I believe we're going to see some protests, what
yeah.
happens in the summer at the conventions. But I mean, it's not just about, you know, the haves and the have-nots. It's about, like, as you said, the petition of grievances, and grievances most of the time equal equality.
Well, not equality. If nothing else, I think grievances show up that we have a process by which people can be heard.
Right.
And I think that's what's important. Bernie Sanders is a wonderful beacon in the night. Even if he's not going to win. I don't want Bernie Sanders to win, I have to tell you, because if we've had gridlock with Mr. Obama for the last 8 years, what right. would we have with Bernie Sanders? We'd have.
But he is a protest candidate.
But
right.
that protest is pushing all candidates on all sides to say, oh, we've got to think about dirty money. We've got to think about how this campaign.
Donald Trump's the same on the other
we've
side.
We've
got to
right. think about this division of wealth in this society.
Right.
That it's no longer simply a racial division. It's how much money do you make? Where do you live? What's your zip code and what do you drive? And so all these things are real. And I think what voting and protest is about, an expression of respectful democratic discontent, that I have a right to be discontent and I have a right to state that and I have a right to vote on that premise.
Isn't that it's so interesting to me as a people that we will protest. We will say, you know, I'm mad at the man.
Yeah.
Or I'm, you know, truth to power. I'm so angry. Right. But they won't exercise the tools and the
right.
things that are given to them by our society, our free society.
That's right. And I think that that's such an important thing that, again, voting is the mechanism by which. But it's an important mechanism. It's not enough to talk. This, you know, I've spent my life in academia. And if I never go to another academic formal discussion that I'm not myself giving for a fee, I'll be very happy because nothing comes out of it. And what happens very often in an academic debate, or somebody gives a lovely speech, what the audience does of other academics, they come up with pithy questions to demonstrate how smart they are,
right.
but nothing gets resolved. I think, hopefully, these campaigns should, you know, mobilize us to thought and action. The problem is, how long can you sustain interest? This campaign has been going on since
yeah.
2013, when there are 14 Republican candidates and 6 Democratic candidates. At this point, I understand people saying a pox on both your houses.
Right.
But when you do that, the only pox is on your own
you
house.
You know, I got to say, just this conversation and thinking more clearly about it, fatigue aside, this could be
you know, I guess the mainstream will say, oh, what a dud of an election. But this is how it's supposed to be. Protest, voting, everything in between. This is actually a very interesting
this
election.
This is a very interesting election, an extremely interesting election. In some sense, the second election of George II, that's how I always refer to him, was not an interesting election. But the reality is we have real issues on the table. And if we go left or right in this country right now, it's going to be dependent upon this. But I do think apathy sets in when we're overwhelmed. You know, it's like, here's my best analogy. Think of your favorite food. Think of it 3 times a day, 7 days a week, you know, 20 every week of the month. Pretty soon it's not. I'm a political right down to my core. But after
too
a
much.
While, I do understand a pox on both of your houses.
Al Jeanne is a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. And he's a resident philosopher here on The Download on WGN. Al, great to see you.
See you soon.
It's a download here on WGN. Justin Kaufman. All right, I'll vote. Al, you convinced me. I'll vote. Coming up, we're going to talk about fantasy sports, which, you know, I have to say, I will say this, and, I'm a fantasy sports I'm not only a fantasy sports player, but I'm pretty good at it.
Oh.
As a matter of fact, I just got a trade, just pinged my phone right now, from someone in our league who will remain nameless, Paul. That is such a low ball offer. It's for Joe Panic, uh-huh. who is the second baseman for the Giants,
yeah.
and Mikhail Franco, who's the third baseman for the Phillies, for Adam Wainwright and Daniel Murphy.
No.
It's terrible. Daniel Murphy's a top 10 player right now. He's having a tremendous season. He's hitting .330, and he's hitting for power in Washington. And Adam Wainwright's having a terrible start to the year, no doubt about it. But Adam Wainwright was also drafted in the top 5 rounds. So Joe Panic, who's a waiver wire pickup, and Mikhail Franco, who's probably an 11th rounder,
mm-hmm.
does not equal value. Sorry, I digress.
Man.
This is not at all a promo for the segment we're going to do on regulating the business of fantasy sports. This is a rant. I'm offended. What do you do? What do you do in this situation? You play. If you get a ludicrous trade offer, do you snark back?
I know. I don't even respond.
You just keep it there, and then they get antsy for 5 days?
Just keep it there. Just let them think about that. Maybe I'm pondering.
Yeah, like they do. Like a seven days, they wake up, they're sweating, they're checking their, oh, God, is Pete going to? Is he going to like it? He likes it. I don't know if he likes it.
Does he just think that you're not going to pay attention?
There's
two
schools of thought in fantasy sports, especially fantasy baseball, because fantasy baseball is a 6-month commitment. I mean, it's March to October, whatever it is. And in that, there's two I come from a more fair trade. I'm a fair trade guy. I like my coffee beans fair trade. I like my fantasy baseball fair trade. I don't mind trading guys. I actually am. I will probably do 15 to 20, 25 trades a year. I love it. It's because it's such a long season. It's like, all right, well, Miguel Cabrera, let's try him. But I don't. There are some that go about it, and just like in the world, where swindle is first, trade is second. The only way they think they get a great offer or trade value is if they rip the other people off. So they try to hide it. So they try to prey on the people in your league. And you know, if you play fantasy sports, you know exactly what I'm talking about. That there's always 3 or 4 people at the bottom of the league that aren't paying that close attention.
Yeah.
And they're like, Mikhail Franco hit a home run yesterday. I'll do it. And so for me, I feel like there's two schools of thought. There's that guy who's like scheming to like trade you junk.
Yeah.
And then there's the other that understands the game and is like, well, I'll get fair value, because, you know, it's not about how good the player is, because they're not consistent. They hit 300. They hit 300. In baseball, that's 3 times out of 10. Like, you can't always have a team where they're hitting home runs every time they come up to bat. So that's why I feel like you could fair trade. Like, I traded Zach Greinke for Miguel Cabrera, straight up. I had Greinke, gave up Cabrera, or got Cabrera. I love Miguel Cabrera. At some point or another, I will ship
Miguel Cabrera. But I'm just saying, like, the value of Zach Greinke, who was the second runner-up to the Cy Young, and yeah, he started a little slow, so did Miguel Cabrera. It, you know, like, that's a fair deal in my mind.
When I was a kid, I feel that I was duped by an older kid in our neighborhood. You know, we were collecting baseball cards.
See?
You know, he was like 3 or 4 years older. Now, you know, it makes a difference when you're that young.
Right.
He would take advantage of my Cub fandom by, you know, say, hey, you know, I got six Keith Morelands.
Listen, I got Dave Martinez, and I got a Vance Law.
I'll take that Ricky Henderson rookie card. Right. You know, Ricky Henderson.
I'll take that Rob Dibble off you. Right. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's what.
Yeah, where it comes from.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, that's not what this segment's about entirely. This is about business, but you know, it should be that there should be a movement for fair trade. Fair trade in fantasy baseball. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the Illinois House may vote on a fantasy sports bill soon. This, of course, after the Attorney General deemed daily sites like FanDuel and DraftKings to be illegal betting and urged Springfield to adapt a law. We've seen other states do the same thing, but by regulating the big businesses like FanDuel and DraftKings and CBS, ESPN, all that kind of stuff, are the smaller companies that do the more traditional season-long customized fantasy sports leagues getting the shaft? Well, maybe not here in Illinois, where the bill would create a sliding scale for taxes and licenses based on the money that is generated. That's good news for David Gerzak, who's the president of the Small Businesses of Fantasy Sports Trade Association. He joins me now. David, thanks for taking some time out tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I'm an avid player. I enjoy playing, and I never once thought about licenses, about taxes, about whether it was legal or illegal. How does this bill that's in the state of Illinois House right now, how does it work?
Well, this bill actually is a little bit different than the bill that got passed in Indiana. In Indiana, there's a $50,000 registration fee, which is, you know, prohibitive for all small operators. Here, they were smart enough to do a sliding scale. So the fees are actually acceptable for all the small businesses. You know, it is being regulated by the gaming board. So some of the things that they're asking us as small businesses to do are very, you know, they're challenging, you know, like doing annual audits, background checks with fingerprinting, which, I mean, to me is kind of hilarious. You know, you're running a season-long fantasy football league and they want to run background checks.
Yeah, right.
And things of that nature, you know, they're a little bit problematic, but I think a lot of our companies can get past them.
I guess that's my question. I mean, the small businesses that you're talking about here are ones that do more customizable fantasy sports leagues. They do daily, but they also do the traditional kind of all league-long, all-season-long kind of stuff. I don't understand how that needs to be regulated.
Well, I mean, philosophically, I absolutely agree with you. In 2006, the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act permitted on a federal level season-long and traditional fantasy sports. That's why that carve-out was why it was, you know, designed and intended for companies like ours. So, I mean, in my opinion, I don't think that we should really be included in these fantasy sports bills. Unfortunately, the language that they're using, they're saying anything with, you know, an athlete performing in the future, that there is an entry fee. It does encompass some of these, some of the leagues like ours. And honestly, it could even encompass like a private fantasy football league where the commissioner may take a rake of some sort. Mm-hmm. That may be something that they need to get licensed or they're technically illegal, which again, I find more or less ludicrous, but this is the world we're living in.
I mean, sites like FanDuel, like you mentioned, DraftKings, which are really big for football. And then even if you bring in the CBSs and the Yahoos and the ESPNs, they're making loot off of this. They're making millions of dollars. Obviously, they can put the commercials on, you know, for every single NFL football game. But when you're talking about some of the smaller businesses, there's not a huge amount of overhead. It's really just the ability to let people play.
Right. And more of it, you know, even as an operator, it's still kind of a passion, you know, a labor of love. You know, there's a single entry fee per season. You're not getting, you know, people churning their dollars every single week like a slot machine. So even a company like Yahoo, a huge company, you know, they're only getting a single entry fee for that person in a season-long league. And even they're having problems with some of these laws that are coming out.
Right. You know, it's interesting to me because are those companies going to change the way they do fantasy sports?
You know, I think that, you know, if you have a concept that you feel is successful, I mean, my company personally is the FFPC. We have a very loyal player base, and we'll just keep doing the business that we're doing. We probably won't get into a whole lot of different stuff.
Do you see fantasy sports as we know it, as the sort of pastime as it has been, changing based on the way that these states are going to start regulating these sites?
Well, you know, it's entirely possible. If states get out of hand, like, for example, Illinois is looking pretty good. It's a large state. But if, like, Texas and Florida and New York and California all have huge, massive licensing fees, it's going to be absolutely detrimental to the entire industry. The small businesses will just not be able to make it anymore, to be honest.
One of the other things in the bill, which I thought to be very interesting, is that there is going to be a restriction on age, so 21 and older. Which is something that, you know, many high school kids play this, and they're not going to be allowed to play at this. But also that employees of fantasy game operators and professional athletes will be barred from participating, mostly because of the idea of collusion or the idea of some sort of conspiracy.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's not a very realistic situation. But we're actually, you know, our organization is in favor of the 21-year age. We think that that's fine. I mean, I know that some prefer 18, but we think it's okay. I don't think the collusion thing's going to come up that much, but it's also fine. If they want to restrict that, we're totally fine with that.
So, you know, as you know, this is, like you mentioned, a passion project. It's a hobby. It's something that at one point migrated from the big boards where you would put the stickers on which player that you took right to the internet. Would it make it just cleaner if it went back and just avoided the internet altogether?
Well, I don't think anyone wants to go back to the USA Today and having to actually get those scores out of the paper.
Right.
But oddly enough, you know, in Las Vegas, in our drafts, we have the option of using electronic draft boards, but our players love actually going up there and having the stickers you put on the board, so we still do that.
What's the time frame for this bill? Do you think this is going to make it through before the end of the spring session?
I mean, we're optimistic. We feel Mr. Zaleski, Representative Zaleski, has done a great job, actually, in trying to pass this bill, so we applaud him for that. And we think that it's going to get through the Senate, and we feel pretty optimistic about it. I mean, again, our only hope is that they don't add any more gambling-type clauses, because you know, people have to realize we're not the Rivers Casino. You know, we're not doing that massive amount of volume. Even FanDuel and DraftKings, they're big, but they're not doing incredible volumes. But the little guys just truly can't afford, you know, these crazy types of things to try and have to comply with.
Yeah, I mean, this is the country is taking a stand against a betting in any form, a gambling in form. They're only letting big companies have it, so you can see where you guys might slip through the cracks. David Gerzak is the president of the Small Businesses of Fantasy Sports Trade Association. He joined me tonight. David, thanks for taking some time out.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
This is a download here on WGN Radio. Justin Kaufman coming up. Very excited. Joseph Adamek will be in studio. We will be listening to some live music from the multi-instrumentalist and drummer from such bands as Caliphone, Iron and Wine, Manischewitz. He's a drummer. He did drummer with Freakwater. Tremendous musician and a Chicago stalwart. So we'll talk with and listen to music from him and some of his friends who are coming in studio in the 10 o'clock hour. That's great. What a treat. That's awesome. Sometimes, you know, it's great. You recognize that so many great musicians live in this town. To have him come in, he's got a new record out, an LP put out just released in the last 2 months.
Awesome.
Called Super Low. So that's great. I mean, you're familiar with those bands.
Yeah. Heck yeah. Freakwater, one of my faves.
Iron and Wine, too. How Jeff Carlin that? From Rokoncho is like geeking out. I think he might have tried to stick around.
California, I mean, great.
Yeah. So that's coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour. Excited. That's an interesting story about the fantasy base or fantasy sports or regulating fantasy sports. You know, I was hoping when I first saw the press release and that this bill was snaking through the House that it was more about sort of legislating the conduct of people who play fantasy sports. As opposed to the businesses. Yeah, I just feel like there should be like a bill of rights, you know, like for, you know, people who do incessant polls.
Oh, yeah. What? Yeah.
What are you doing polls? Stop doing polls. If you do, and this is a plea to CBS and the ESPN and the Yahoo, stop giving us the option to do polls. Nobody needs a poll. Because ultimately what happens is they say, Should we get rid of stolen bases? And three people take the poll, right? And there's a 12-person league, and then you sit there, and then you get – then that leads to all staffs. 12, you know, person emails. They're like, guys, we put up a poll. Can you please click the thing and put up a poll? And it's around and around. It's a vicious cycle.
So I think there should be something about that. Also, what I got mad about on Sunday is, you know, they have this, you know, we play in a league where you're head-to-head, and it's by categories. So there's 14 categories that you play by. Some are positive, some are negative, and you can end by winning 7, you know, 8-6. And so there's strategy when it comes to what players you pick and where, especially when you get to the weekend, because you're like, some are negative categories. So you're like, well, do I not play? So I've seen some drastic moves where somebody will be playing and they realize that the only way that they're going to win is by benching every single player because they don't want to strike out. If a guy gets a strikeout, they're going to lose. So they bench everybody.
Yeah, that's...
And you realize that's not even like...
That's not fun.
That's not
they're
fun
kind
at
of
all.
Like...
No. You know, now you're like...
Cheating
the
system.
You're like
or
Billy
something.
Bean of fantasy baseball. Mm-hmm. So the guy I was playing on Sunday, when we started the day... He had David Price, who was facing the Yankees.
Yeah.
He had the better matchup.
Mm-hmm.
And I had Clayton Kershaw, who was going up against the Padres. And if you remember what happened on Sunday, Clayton Kershaw in the 3 o'clock hour on the West Coast dominated. He dominated. 14 strikeouts, no runs. I think it was a complete game. 8 innings, if not complete. Just now it's your turn, David Price.
Yeah.
Right?
Set the table.
My guy responded to my motivation, my pep talk. I sat Clayton down Sunday morning, and I'm like, you got to come through. So, you know, but he still had an option. If David Price would have pitched 7 or 8 innings and done the same thing, he would have won categories. But instead, 5 minutes before the Red Sox and the Yankees played, he benched David Price because he recognized that it was probably impossible for David Price to throw like Clayton Kershaw did and that he would lose some of the negative categories. We have walks. So he would have walked 2 guys and lost the category.
So don't you, like in fantasy, I'm not really familiar with fantasy baseball. So in fantasy football.
They lock.
Yeah, you can't. So he benches a pitcher. Doesn't he have to put another pitcher in his spot?
No, you can just drop the guy. You just, or just bench him and then, because you don't have to have that slot filled.
Yeah.
That's a good point because we are a veteran league, so I don't think there's that weird sort of you have too many players. Like, we just police ourselves. So I guess I could maybe on a technicality be like, he only had 3 starters that day. He should get 0 for the whole week. But anyway, he benched him. So when I got home after some of the James Beard stuff on that Sunday night, really nice wine, and I saw this because I was like, ooh, I'm looking for it. And I thought that my score would be bigger. Like, I thought it'd be like 10-4, but it ended up being like not 8-6 or something. Like, what happened? And it's because it wasn't even that much of a difference. It was like maybe 9-5 instead. And so, yeah, so then I realized what he did. So what I did was I fired off about 15 trades and like did every bad player that I have. One up for David Price. I'm like, well, if you're not going to play him, you don't like him, right?
And then I went
a little further. That wasn't enough. This is all, mind you, 1 o'clock in the morning.
A couple of wines.
Yeah, and then I went to the all staff, you know, to everybody, and I said, Jason, that's who I was playing. Jason's looking to trade David Price. I'm like, since he's a coward and he won't play him, he obviously doesn't value his number one pitcher who he drafted in the first round, so he's looking for offers. Primarily backup catchers and middle relievers, best offer. Nobody responded to it. So on Monday morning when I woke up a little blurry-eyed, I'm like, what did I do here? And then I woke up to an inbox with Jason saying, screw off. Like, he was mad. He's like, hey, you know what?
This is how you play the game?
He was just mad at me. He was just mad because I was harassing him. But I was like, and then I just dropped it. But I was hoping that it could have really got. What I like is when they get personal. We had one great experience one time where they were going at each other. Two guys are going at it, and it was like back and forth. And then one of the guys was like, "Well, at least I don't wear acid wash jeans to work."
Oh my god,
something like that. And then he's like, "That's below the belt. Don't talk about my." I was like, "Oh, that's so great! That's so great! That's so great!"
That's
I was
hardcore.
Like, "More, more, more."
So it's hard to wrap my head around baseball fantasy just because it's every day and there's so many teams and so many players.
Yeah.
You play the entire season?
You play up to the end of the regular season.
Or, you know, just like
playoffs.
Football, a couple days.
You know, it goes fast. I mean, we're already into May. We already did April. April's all gone.
And how? So you play it like every day you're playing a
Monday through Sunday.
Yeah, against one person.
Against one person. And every category is in play, and there's some positive and some negative categories, and you play 14 across, and you play till Sunday. And so at the end, you count those up, and then you get a win or a loss. Or what? In our case, we go by how many categories you won. So the best in the league at the end of the season will have be like 125 and 70 or something like that.
So I could just imagine with the amount of time and effort that you're putting into this, the prize must be like 50K. 100,000? What do we...
That's
gotta
the
be
joke.
Sure.
That's the joke of it. There's no real prize. It's just really for the love of the game. It's for the love of the game. That's the joke of it. I talk like I'm a huge, serious player.
Hell, the amount of
I'm a serious player who...
Be intense.
At the end, I think it's a $25 Starbucks card.
Well,
so, yeah, right. So, no, I guess it's not that serious.
Two Frappuccinos.
There's probably people out there that are like, yeah, we're talking real money. I don't do real money. But I would do good at it. Like in the football season, I'd played a little FanDuel, and I was like, I could do this. But then you're like, no, I can't. None of this is in anyone's control. Oh, you pick Tom Brady? Oh, you're a genius. Like, there's no control. There's no rhyme or reason to it. And people that do it just want to control or have power in their life when they have none. It's as simple as that. So, anyway, coming up, we're gonna hear some live music here on the download. Stay with us. Welcome back to the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on May 15th, Chicago musician Joe Adamek will be on stage at the Hideout for a record release party. Adamek has primarily been a drummer for bands like Manischewitz, Caliphone, and Iron and Wine. But he's also a multi-instrumentalist who has released a new solo record. It's called Super Low, out on the record label Minomoso. Is that close? Is that the...
Minomoso.
See, I knew it. I wanted to fact-check that before. It was one of those things. Adamek has played with several bands and Chicago musicians in his time here, and he's here tonight to play some live music, and he's brought friends, Gillian Lizay, is that correct? And Andy Frickle. Yep. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks, everybody, for being here, and we're going to hear some live music. We'll probably take the break to do a little sound check to get ready. But welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's great to be
here. So, I mean, this is big for you. I mean, to have a solo record. I mean, you've played with all the bands that I mentioned. Some mm-hmm. of those are tremendous, tremendous bands, not just here in Chicago, but mm-hmm. around the country, around the world. What's it mean for you to go out on your own and try something different?
Well, I've always, like you said, I've recorded with lots of different people and... you know, I've done things where I end up doing many different instruments and, you know, do like a whole section of a song. And it just seems like a lot of that is me. And I decided I wanted to do that just on my own and see what happens.
For you, I mean, I say multi-instrumentalist. we'll put the picture up on our website as well as all the instruments we have in studio. What does that mean?
Well, I studied when I was younger. I started playing drums, and I always had a desire to play melody instruments. And I think the drums are very melodic, but not like a guitar is melodic. And so I would gravitate towards these other instruments. My father played guitar, so I took his guitar. When I was probably about 10, it just came into my room, and that was no longer his, you know,
right.
But he wasn't playing it at the time. And my grandfather played clarinet, so I took that into my little, you know, room, teenage bedroom. And, you know, I just started experimenting with these things. So I've always done that with other instruments. And I think that for me, multi-instrument, I mean, it's just an extension of what I like to hear. You know?
I mean, just in studio right here, what do we have? Gillian, what do we have in front of you? And also, I mean, you have guitars that are lined up. Is that the clarinet behind you?
Yeah.
This is a tremoloa.
A tremoloa. There we go.
Yeah, that's mine. It's a very bizarre instrument. It's like a zither or like an auto harp, I guess. And it was made in the 20s through the 40s to play popular Hawaiian music by yourself.
Caliphone's kind of been an experimental rock band. Iron mm-hmm. and Wine's a little bit more, you know, sort of mm-hmm. straight ahead right. Rock or you know, a little bit of folk, things like yeah. that. But I mean...
for you, how important is it to sort of use more instruments and try to expand your palate as a musician?
Well, I love just like orchestration, and you know, like I love people like Gil Evans and you know, classical composers, you know. But for me, it's interesting to hear those types of orchestration put into a different context, you know, like Sun Ra, someone I really like, who all of a sudden there's something very strange, you know, it's like some drunk marching band walking down the street or something. But then all of a sudden, if you can incorporate that into an arrangement in something else, I like combining those two things, you know.
Well, I mean, it shows obviously in the music on Super Low, but I mean, you have a background that spans past rock and roll. I mean, you'll play in jazz bands, you'll play all. Mm-hmm. For you, is there a particular style of music that you gravitate towards, or is it part of your, you know, musicianship to be open to all styles?
Well, that was something I struggled with when I was making this record. I actually recorded a version of some of these songs with a band, which included a lot of very talented jazz musicians in Chicago. And I had to take a step back, and I really thought about what separate myself from, you know, like sort of this demographic of you are a jazz drummer, you are a rock drummer, and really, you know, it was like a meditative process of what is the full picture? What do I want to do? And it had nothing to do with one particular style. So the record is just, I don't think of it as one style. I just think of it as a, you know, one statement, I guess. And yeah, it's hard to get branch out of, you know, categories. But yeah, that's what I was trying.
Well, it defies categories, and we're going to hear some of it coming up here on the download. Joe Adamick's in studio. We'll take a break here so we can sound check this, because there are instruments everywhere. We're going to have fun with this while we go to a commercial break. When we come back, we'll hear some live music from Joe, from Gillian, from Andy. The new record is Super Low, and we will hear from these guys when we return. Stay with us. All right, I'm so excited. This is great. Joe Adamick is in studio. He has brought Gillian Lizet and Andy Fricka with him. Gillian, what are you playing?
I'm playing bass.
You're playing bass, okay. Andy, what do we got over here?
We got a French horn over here.
A French horn.
Yeah.
All right, and then Joe, what are you playing in this one?
This is a Goya acoustic guitar.
Love it! And we got a nice little drum track. This is going to be fun. The record is called Super Low. It's out. It's LP. The LP is right here in my hand, which is great. I love that. And then also you can get it online. Okay, so Joe, what are we going to hear? What are we going to hear first here?
This is the second song on my record called Swimming Pool.
Swimming Pool. All right, some live music from Joe Adamick and crew here. The record called Super Low here on the download. Let's do it.
Jumping in the swimming pool, what'd you expect me to do? Jump into. Swimming with your clothes on, all the mother's stare, and I look on. We left you, or was it taken away? Wild animals packed in the back of the car. You and your voices all alone. Held you in my arms, I
I should have held you in my arms.
Awesome. Joe Adamick, Gillian Lizé, and Andy Frickle. The song Swimming Pool from the Swimming Pool, is that was the full song? Swimming Pool? Or
that's
Jump
right.
Into the Swimming Pool. Swimming. Okay, Swimming Pool. From the record Super Low, the solo record for Joe Adamick, who has been a drummer, longtime drummer for bands like Manischewitz, Caliphone, Iron and Wine. Tremendous work. I mean, you could tell. I mean, the There's a real beauty to the music. I mean, it's just, there's something there with the when we talk about multi-instrumental. It's not just sort of excess of instruments. There's vocals, everything that puts together. You guys really putting a tapestry together here tonight.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. All right, so you want to, let's take a break. We'll get a break and we'll get to the news and we'll hear some more songs. You
all right,
do that?
Thanks
that
a lot.
Sounds great, Joe. That was great.
Thank you.
This is a download. We're live in the Allstate studio down here on Michigan Avenue. It's a download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Joe Adamick. He's a longtime drummer and multi-instrumentalist here in Chicago for bands like Manischewitz, Caliphone, Iron and Wine. He's now has a solo record. It's called Super Low. He's got a Hideout record release party at the Hideout on May 15th, 1354 West Wabanzia. Also in studio with us, Gillian Lizay and Andy Frickle. Andy's got the French horn, Gillian's got the bass, and some other stuff. Stuff all over the place. I love it. You know, you, Joe, I mean, it's, we're going to hear live music in just a second, but I mean, you, I mean, name these bands. I mean, it's almost like a name dropping experience because you've worked with so many, and I'm not even getting to half of the musicians, the actual individuals we've worked with. For you being from Chicago and growing up here and being a part of this music scene, what does it afford you to have grown up here and be a part of it? I mean, are the relationships and your sort of Rolodex a mile long at this point?
I do know a lot of people in Chicago. I've played with a lot of different scenes. You know, I started out playing jazz in Chicago, and you know, but I've done lots of other things. I play with Freakwater. They're more of like a country band. And and then when I got involved with Caliphone, I started playing with more like the indie rock scene. But yeah, I find that in Chicago, there's a lot of camaraderie within the scenes, and I think it's a comfortable place to live. It's maybe less so now than when I first, you know, was growing up here. But that allows people to be less, you know, harsh. Like in New York, everybody sort of, it's amazing. You know, New York is great, but in Chicago, you know, you hang out in people's backyards, and you know, there's a little more of camaraderie here, I think.
Gillian, we were talking in the break just about you came here, from the East Coast.
Yeah.
Why did you come to Chicago?
Well, exactly what Joe said. It's that like music community here is not like in New York. In New York, it's just hard. There's no space, and you know, it's just really competitive. And here, people, there's always like gear sharing, and you know, or at least it was when I moved here, you know, 18 years ago.
18 years, and you stayed. That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we were just talking about this a couple hours ago, just about, you know, a lot of musicians are leaving the coast for places like Nashville, because there's an industry there. How does Chicago compare? Because I think of Chicago as a tremendous music scene, but not necessarily an industry.
That's right. Yeah, it used to be. There used to be a lot of jingle houses, and my teacher when I was growing up, drum teacher Tom Tedrin, he would always show up and tell me about the commercials he did downtown, and that's really changed a lot. Partially it's because the whole industry is changed, and people can do, you know, music at their house and in their studios at home, and studios are going out of business left and right in Chicago. So the industry aspect of it is changing, and live music is changing too, and I think you really need to be flexible to continue to make a living.
I was going
to
say, you've been in some bands that have had commercial success, but how do you as a musician make a living in Chicago?
You have to be open-minded, I guess, you know. You got to be like, yeah, I am going to do that. Not like, oh god, I don't want to do, you know. Yeah, you got to just be like, yeah, let's do it, and you know, but the good thing is people here, you know, everybody's pretty good. There's a high level of musicianship here, so even if you're on some weird gig somewhere, everybody's pretty good, and you probably know half the guys, and you know, you probably played with them before, so and everybody, you know, everybody's cool, and you get along, so you got to be flexible and just be willing to do kind of,
you know, I mean, obviously working in a big city like Chicago, a lot of touring bands and people come through, and you get these big shows at Metro or even the bigger houses, and they're looking for opening bands and things of that nature. But there seems to be, you know, Chicago has gone from, you know, great place to play music to almost like the epicenter when it comes to the festival season as we come here. I mean, now it's like it seems like every third month there's, yeah. you know, Paul McCartney's playing somewhere in, you know, like yeah, in Grand Park or something like that. But it's changed in the way that it seems. Does that help or hurt that exposure with the sort of Chicago being such so much bigger when it comes to the commerce and the industry? Does it help or hurt the sort of independent scene here?
Yeah, it's... I think what's changed here is, yeah, there are more concerts and bands, and you go and you do your show rather than just general work for musicians. You know, now it's like a jazz band becomes a group, and, you know, maybe they go and tour Poland or something, but they're not playing, you know, at the Playboy right. Club 6 nights a week. You know, so it's like you got
to. So work is harder to find.
It's different. Yeah,
it's different.
Yeah, it's. I think it's still there. I think you can still do it, but it's like you really got to be able to change and flexible with that. Yeah.
Joe Adamek, his new record "Super Low" is out. The record release party is going to be on May 15th at the Hideout. All right, let's enough talk. Let's hear some music. What are we going to hear here?
This is called "Working for More Than Pay."
Perfect.
This is loosely based on Shackleton's expedition, if you're familiar with that.
All right, here we go.
2, 4. We were working for more than pay.
Joe Adamek, Gillian Lizay, and Andy Frickle. We had a lot. I need to also, I guess, introduce all the instruments that were on that song. We heard from Sigourney. Tell us who's Sigourney.
Sigourney is my Rosewood contra alto clarinet.
And then what we had the Hawaiian instrument over here.
Yeah,
that
the tremoloa.
The tremoloa. Mm-hmm. The French horn mm-hmm. that Andy was playing. Mm-hmm. The bass came in there, the guitar, and the vocal.
Yeah.
All right. You guys got one more in you?
Yeah.
All right, let's do that after the break here. Joe Adamek, Gillian Lizay, and Andy Frickle in studio. The show is at the Hideout. The record release party for Super Low is on May 15th. We'll continue with live music here on The Download. When we return, stay with us. All right, back here on The Download on 720 WGN. Joe Adamek is in studio with me, along with Gillian Lizay and Andy Frickle, musicians here in Chicago. They got a show. Joe's got a show for his new record, Super Low. It'll be at the Hideout, 1354 West Wabansie, on May 15th. Also, Joe is drummer for bands like Manischewitz, Caliphone, Iron and Wine, Freakwater. Has worked with several musicians here in town. And I can't thank you enough for coming in, bringing some of the instruments, everything. It's great. It's really great to meet you, and it's great to be able to have you here. So, you know what? As we get tight on time, let's do one more song. You guys want to do one more?
Yeah, let's do
one. All right,
what
do we got here?
This is called Waking Up.
Waking Up.
Which we'll be doing in a few hours.
All right, exactly. Joe Adamek, Gillian Lizay, and Andy Frickle, Waking Up. Here on The Download.
Waking up now to the weight of my house. Let the sun in, let the little boy out. Took me a while, I'm not sure. My space, I give up my days. I hate the lies for being so obtuse. Say it's hard, but that ain't no excuse. She cut the TV cord, cut the phone line. Take me down low, it it's the way that it goes. Waking up now to the weight of my house.
All right, there we go. All right, Joe Adamick, Gillian Lizay, and Andy Frickel in studio. Waking up, the show that will be a record release party for Super Low.
Yeah, it's going to be at the Hideout. A lot of fun. Big Sadie is opening up, and they're an amazing band as well. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
So is it going to be the three of you? Who's all in the? Who is going to be on stage that night?
Well, Gillian, Andy, Marty. Kellenberger is going to be playing horn and F, as it's known, as well, French horn. Jim Becker and Ben Massarella, both my co-bandmates from Caliphone days, are going to be playing with me, which I'm very excited
about. Wow, that's great.
And also Sam Wagster on guitar.
How's it feel to have a record release party?
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's actually my anniversary. So
really? Yeah, congratulations.
My wedding anniversary.
That's so great.
My beautiful wife and I will be celebrating that as well.
Celebrating on the stage. That's the way to go.
Yeah,
all right. Joe Adamick, Gillian Lizay, Andy Frickels, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Right. Thank you, Justin.
Record release party will be at the Hideout on May 15th. Thanks, guys. All right, that's going to do it for the download tonight. Tomorrow on the program, Rick Bayless.
Ooh.
Yeah, Rick Bayless is opening the brand new concept in the West Loop. He opened it today, Cinco de Mayo.
What's the latest, his latest take
it's
on
a,
Mexican?
It's
now?
A brew pub.
Mexican brew pub?
I'm not sure that, I don't know, I'm going to ask him. It's a Mexican name. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but the...
Well, then I would assume it's going to be Mexican.
Yeah,
he's not
going to
name it my new Mexican named Italian place.
I know, right?
That would
well,
be odd.
You know what?
But
it
you never know,
odd.
Rick would
you
pull it off, wouldn't he?
Matt Bubala in studio. Good to see you, buddy.
It's
how
good to see you too, man. How are you doing?
Good, good. That's, so
I was
what
enjoying
you got tonight?
The band.
Yeah.
Elf and I were swinging back there.
So good, man. So good. Those are some top-notch musicians, man. Whenever you can get a alto clarinet into the studio, you got to feel like you've accomplished something for the
That's
day.
Right. That's
what
right,
do you got yeah. on the show tonight?
We've got Sam Panayotovic, our own Tribune Sports reporter.
Absolutely.
Sam Panayotovic is out at the Cell, and I'm making him come here afterwards because I are you a Sox fan?
I am a Sox fan.
You're a Sox fan. Okay.
Yeah.
What the hell is with you people?
What did we do wrong? Win?
Easy.
No. Here's the thing, Martyr.
He's got his Cubs
All
shirt
I hear
on
from
here.
You Sox fans my whole life, and this is my mother-in-law included, right? You Cubs fans, the big brewery on the north side, you go to the beer garden. That's what you do. You just go. You don't care about baseball. You don't watch baseball. You go to get drunk. And I've heard this forever,
yeah.
right? And here we are.
Guilty.
Cubs, awesome team, drawn well as always, right?
As
and
always.
Granted, when the Cubs suck, we still go there because it's a fun place to
yeah.
go. Sox fans, we're real baseball fans. The team's got to be good. You're drawing 18,000 people right now.
There is no doubt.
What is wrong with you?
Hold on.
Buy
hold
a ticket
on.
And go to a game. If you're such a Sox fan and you want to yell at Cubs fans and be all high and mighty, go to your freaking stadium.
Well, I don't
and
go to any studio. I don't go to any stadium before May 31st. That's a rule. It's too cold in Chicago. I just won't do it. Like tonight, everyone's out there and it's
that's dumb.
No,
a,
it's not.
That
dumb.
Means you're incredibly
no,
soft.
No, that means that I'm
soft.
Not paying. A family ticket of $150 to go. No, I can't do it. I'm a summer baseball guy.
Were you
guy.
Born in Hawaii?
No, I've gone to Bears games.
Long?
I understand the value of it. It's just a straight. So the second thing is
support your team.
Half of
because come
people,
trade deadline,
hey,
when
Justin,
they're selling instead of doing anything, you're they shouldn't be. They should be. But nobody went to a game to support the team at all.
Yeah, but Justin, you and I could pay $65 a ticket to sit behind a post at Wrigley Field.
That's right.
That's restricted view.
It's got you there. A lot of people go to Wrigley Field for tourism.
Absolutely.
So you guys have
no doubt about
that. That is
built in. Built in. We're going to, and that's why the Cubs were able.
You'd be pulling
and that's why the Cubs were able to do what they did for the last 5 years, tank it and still draw enough people to get by.
The Chicago Cubs,
absolutely.
Because of the GN Superstation, because of everything involved, has a
There's
national
no
following that
There's
the White
no
Sox
doubt.
Has a local following. And the local following is not coming to games in April and May. They'll be there when it counts. And right now we're like, hey, I actually like
They're
that.
Barely there when it counts too, though, Justin.
Yeah,
that's
I don't
the
know,
problem.
Man. That was some intimidating stuff when the Sox won the... World Series.
Yes, you guys did come out to support the World Series. Good job.
Well, there's not too many times. We talked to Rick Hahn about it. It's been 10 years since they've been in the playoffs.
I understand, but your team is out for the hottest start. Go see your team. That's so ridiculous. Oh, I don't go in May. It's cold outside.
No way. Sorry.
Oh, my God.
I just don't do it.
This is...
Also, I have a show from 7 to 11 every night.
Well, that's a problem.
I don't think Chris Sale's been accused of using PEDs. Has he been? Has he, Justin?
Oh, jeez. Not yet, but Stephen A. Smith will get to him. Don't you worry.
Well, it's a good... that's good. Let's see what Penionovich is more of a... He's a true... Sox guy, South Sider. So let's see what he says about that. Yeah. All right, Matt, have a great show.
Thank you very much. I'll see you tomorrow night.